So let's take the refuges and precepts together.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Panatipata veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Abrahmacharya veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Musavada veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Sura merya majapamadatana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Vikala bhojana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Nacha gita vadita visukadasana malaganda vilepana dharana mandana vibhusanatana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Uchasayana mahasayana veramani sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Idam me silam magapalanyanasa pachayo hotu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
So I wanted to continue tonight with the topic I began my last talk a few days ago, talking about some of the teachings from the Visuddhimagga, called the Path of Purification in English, which was this important text written by the 5th century scholar monk, Visuddhimagga. No, Visuddhimagga is the name of the text. Buddhaghosa. Visuddhimagga by Buddhaghosa. And I just mentioned last time, but to review how this is a text, it's based on the suttas, other material from the Pali Canon, but just trying to flesh out in a lot more detail the how to practice, the path of practice, how insight arises, what insight actually is, as understood by this very major monastery in Sri Lanka at the time. And this text has been a big influence, whether we realize it or not, on the way that we practice here in the West. Somebody commented that you don't often hear talks specifically about the Visuddhimagga, but actually really we're hearing talks about the Visuddhimagga all the time because the approach that's presented there is really intrinsic to the way that we practice here in this modern mindfulness Vipassana movement. So I started off talking about some of the teachings around insight, beginning with what's called purification of view. The filtering out of our misunderstandings, all of the impurities that we have around what's really happening now, so that we can correctly see mental and physical phenomena. That's what's meant by purification of view, being able to correctly see mental and physical phenomena. How they're arising, how they're passing, how they're flowing and changing moment by moment. So in my last talk, I went through the experience of the body, what's actually happening in the body in the present moment in a certain amount of detail. Could go into even more detail. Leave that to you guys in your practice. I just had a time to touch a little bit on mental phenomena, so I wanted to go into a little bit more detail on what's going on in the mind tonight. So as our mindfulness, our concentration gets stronger, usually through awareness of the body, then we do start to pick up on more of what's going on in the mind. For some of us, that comes a little easier. For others of us, it may take a little more persistence, really training with the body for quite some time until the mind starts to come into focus, what's going on there, because the mental realm is more subtle. It's not as obvious as what's going on in the body. So the approach that's laid out here in the Visuddhimagga and also in the suttas, if we read the suttas, you know, the Buddha in his great wisdom instructed us how to follow the path of least resistance. You know, so start where it's easy, you know, start where it's obvious and clear, and then gradually, as the mind settles and is able to pick up on more, then notice more, but really not to push or to strive. So the model that's used in the Visuddhimagga and also usually in the suttas for what goes on in the mind is the four mental aggregates out of that model of the five aggregates, one of them being physical, and then there being these four mental aggregates that cover everything that the mind does. So that includes vedana, feeling tone of pleasure and pain. It includes perception, what might be called conceptualization or ideation. It includes consciousness, just the ability of the mind itself to know, to be aware. And then what's called mental formations, which is just everything else. It's kind of the catch-all category. So, you know, that's not the only way to deconstruct what's going on in the mind. It's not the only way to categorize and divide up and get a grip on what the mind does. But it's the traditional one. It's kind of a fairly straightforward one. And useful for many of us. That model is useful. So, let's see. So, as I mentioned a little bit, the three aggregates of vedana and perception and consciousness, those are a little more specific in what they refer to. It can be a little bit easier to get intellectually a grip on what those include and then that other aggregate of mental formations has a somewhat broader range. It includes a whole host of things. But I find it helpful as a first approximation to think of mental formations basically as thoughts and emotions, right? If you've done some studying, you know that there's more to it than that. You know, there's a lot in there. But kind of as in terms of what we actually experience in our practice and how we're seeing mental formations, thoughts and emotions is kind of a good first approximation. And despite the seeming complexity of the mind, just like with the body, you know, the mind throws an even greater variety of experiences at us. You know, said that the mind can go anywhere. You know, with this physical body, we're fairly limited in where we can go and how fast we can get there. But in just a moment with the mind, you know, we can be on Mars. You know, the mind just can go all over the place and imagine things that could never actually exist in physical reality. It's even more varied and has a greater range than the body does. And yet the actual functions that the mind performs, the types of activities it engages in, what it actually does, you know, as kind of a functioning organ, a functioning sense organ, is also a fairly limited set of things that we can know, those experiences that are happening in the present moment. And all of that is what we call nama. So the physical realm is the rupa, the realm of form, realm of physicality, materiality, and everything that goes on in the mind is nama, the realm of mentality, mental experience. So starting with thoughts, because for many of us that's the first place where we start to tune into what's going on in the mind is with what we might think of as fully formed thought, full-fledged thoughts. So, you know, usually early on in our practice, we're just starting to meditate. We have the experience of getting lost in thought. Or still later on in our practice, having the experience of getting lost in thought, and then still later on also. But at the beginning, you know, we have that experience of, oh, the mind's constantly drifting off, but then at some point, we wake up, right? And even if there's not a whole lot of awareness of what's going on in the mind at that point, there's some sense that, oh, thinking was happening, right? So this is often the first thing that we notice going on in the mind. As we get lost in thought, we wake up, there's some ability to be aware on just maybe even a really high level that thinking has been happening. And that's different than what goes on in the body. So that's a different kind of experience. People at this point often have the thought, and you may have had the thought as, well, where are thoughts? Where are thoughts happening, right? If we've been resting in the body a lot and honing the mindfulness on the physical realm, then when we notice a thought in the mind, it's like not in a place that we recognize. As Westerners, we're kind of taught that thinking happens in the brain, right? Like we always point up here when we talk about thinking or things going on in the mind. But the actual experience of it in the present moment is not that it's here, right? Like we don't feel a thought in here. You know, so where is it? You know, it can be kind of confusing. It's like it opens a new door. There's this whole realm of mentality, of nama, that doesn't happen in the body. It happens in its own unique sense sphere, the sphere of the mind. So at first, you know, we just catch thoughts when we wake up from them, right? We don't actually see them playing out in their entirety. And still, that's often the case, you know, after years or decades of practice. But as we get, you know, more skilled in the mindfulness practice, then there are times, at least, and sometimes long times, when we can see, you know, the thought arises, and it kind of plays out and does its thing, and then it ends. And then here comes the next one, and it plays out, and it does its thing, right? We get to see that parade of passing thoughts. Which appear different ways. I find this really interesting to check out the different ways that thought appears in the mind. And it's interesting, you know, talking to different people and seeing like how differently thought manifests. You know, it's still relatively limited range, but you know, some of us are very visual and have like images that flash, you know, like kind of like frames of a movie. Others of us are very verbal and it's like a podcast that's always playing, right? You know, for me, it's actually like growing up. And still, I take my kids sometimes to the East Coast beaches, you know, which are kind of their whole own scene. But the one that we go to on the Atlantic coast has these advertising planes that they fly up and down the coast, you know. So if you're sitting on the beach watching the ocean and doing whatever you're doing, like there's a plane comes by, it says, "Eat at Joe's Crab Shack, you know, best beer on the beach," right? And it's got a long banner like that's flying out behind the end of the plane, right? I don't know if you guys have seen these. And here comes one, and then very soon there'll be another one. It's like this steady stream of the advertising flying past. So I kind of experience it like that. But however we experience it, we at some point start to be able to pick up on that kind of constant narrative, in whatever form it takes, images, pictures, for some of us kind of a more kinesthetic felt senses. So we start then to really get a sense of that mental space, that mental sphere, you know, the place, which isn't really a place, but the domain, the dimension in which all of that mental activity is arising and passing. And if we leave aside all of the content of the thoughts, you know, all the messages on the banners and the ticker tape passing by, then thinking itself is actually a fairly straightforward activity of mind, right? It's fairly, you know, it's not, there's really not that much to it. It's just the mind chattering, you know, it's words, it's images, it's scrolling by, telling a story, little snippets of this and that. It's a fairly kind of straightforward function of mind. One of my teachers, in talking about the kind of the mind door, as we call it, that sense organ of the mind, talked about how the function of the mind is to secrete thoughts, which I found a really interesting image and kind of helped me to relax around thinking. It's like, you know, we've got these various glands in our body, they secrete various substances. You know, the mind is also, I think, technically, scientifically, just a big gland. You know, it secretes thoughts. That's what it does. It just kind of like oozes out or sometimes gushes out, you know, thoughts. That's what it does. And, you know, like I said, it can tell all sorts of different stories. As we know, you know, the mind is just amazing in what it can generate. It's totally shameless in what it'll throw at us. You know, dredging up things from the past, imagining things in the future, trying to figure out things in the present. But regardless of the content, if we just step out of the content, set aside the content, and look at just the actual experience of thinking, that function of thinking, the process of thinking, then that's, you know, that's an experience that we can know, just the same as we can know heat in the body, just the same as we can know a sound in the ear, just the same as we can know any physical experience, we can know that experience of thinking separate from the content of the thinking. So we've got thoughts, kind of big component of mental formations is emotion. And for some of us, you know, this may be easier or harder to pick up on than thinking. For a lot of us, you know, thinking may be very clear, those of us that are more analytical, but we can be really cut off from our emotions, right? When we first come to practice, it can be really hard to actually feel what are we feeling, or you'd even know that we're feeling anything. Speaking from personal experience here, some of us seem to come to practice believing that we don't really have an emotional life. We're just not very emotional people until, you know, that door opens and we discover, oh, it's actually in there. I just couldn't see it. And for some of us, it may be the way around. You know, some of us are very in touch with kind of the heart and the emotional component of our experience, and thinking and thoughts may be kind of fuzzy or out of focus, it may be kind of confusing, but we get a clear read on the underlying emotion that's there. So it can be both of those ways for us at different times. And emotion includes obviously a whole range of, you know, in the Abhidhamma and in the Visuddhimagga, they don't really talk about emotion, but they talk about mental states. States of mind. So that includes the difficult states of mind that fall within the hindrances, so all the different flavors of craving and aversion and confusion. But it also includes all the beautiful states, you know, states of love, compassion, joy, gratitude, generosity, all of those beautiful states are also emotions, mental states. And it also includes neutral emotions, we might call them, which this deviates a little bit from our Western idea of emotion. So things like energy, concentration, that are qualities of mind, right? Factors of mind, mental states, being concentrated or being unconcentrated, being energized or being unenergized, that don't have any intrinsic kind of moral value. You know, it depends on how we use them, right? Energy can be wholesome or it can be unwholesome, depending on what we do with it. Thoughts and emotions, both can come in different intensities, right? So some are really obvious, some can be much more subtle, hard to pick up on. So mental states, like, you know, you've probably got the ones on the top of your list that are really clear. Some of us are real anger wallahs, you know, it comes up with great intensity and it's very obvious. Some of us are real craving wallahs, you know, the lust or something else that we really want comes up and it's very obvious. And it's said that these are actually really good teachers because they help us to connect with this mental realm, you know, if they're really obvious. It's actually said that people who have a lot of anger tend to get enlightened more quickly because it's so obvious and so painful. There's like no avoiding it. But then there are also, you know, these much more subtle mental states and emotions, which you probably also had this experience that there'll be some mental state present that's subtle, like calm. Maybe calm is one that we can miss for a long time, or equanimity. It can take a long time to actually get a read on what is equanimity, because they're just so subtle that they fly under the radar until the mindfulness gets sensitive enough to pick up on them. And it is really difficult to describe in words what an emotion or a mental state is, right? Like, it's always hard to have this conversation, like, How does that emotion feel in the mind, right? I always end up kind of doing this, you know, you guys may have noticed me talking, you know, because it's this texture, right? It's this kind of taste or feeling in the mind. It's hard to wrap words around it, hard to wrap concepts around it. But that's the direct experience of it in the moment, right? The direct experience of it in the moment isn't that word, anger, it's that, you know, that quality in the mind. So, you know, our exploration of this aspect of mental phenomena in the moment is that feeling into that texture, feeling into that quality, the flavor of the mind, of that mental state or emotion. Often we'll pick up on emotion, you know, and earlier in the practice, this is usually how we kind of key into it or learn about emotion when we're beginning is through the physical manifestation, right? There's a strong mind-body link where emotions generate physical sensations, and vice versa also, right? But, you know, when we're in the grip of some strong emotion, for sure, like anger or lust, there's going to be a pronounced manifestation of it in the body, both pleasant and unpleasant. You know, so pleasant mental states, you know, a number of you have been reporting, can produce really lovely sensations in the body. You know, when we get into a place of concentration, tranquility, it can generate all this pleasure in the body, pleasant feeling in the body. So learning to see the distinction between the actual mental state that's happening in the mental plane and those physical manifestations is part of this seeing more clearly what's really happening in the moment. You know, so can we see that there's, you know, maybe the clenching in the stomach and tightness in the throat? And that's the physical experience. But then in the mind, there's also this texture of anger, you know. And they're connected, they're interdependent, they're related, but they're different things. That physical experience is happening in the tactile realm, manifesting as, you know, heat and pressure and whatever it is. And the mental state of anger is happening in the mental realm, manifesting as that flavor, flavor of anger. Different but related. So another one of the mental phenomena that is very helpful to learn to tune into, that we do learn to tune into as we go along in practice, is what's called vedana, or feeling tone, which is, this is one of these ones that just does not have a good translation in English, which is telling in and of itself that we have no word for this really fundamental aspect of life, right? So vedana is the fact, the experience that in every moment there's some impression of experience as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And actually, the whole spectrum of that, right? So I often think of the image of like when an old-fashioned meter on the car, like the fuel gauge. If anybody still has a car that has a fuel gauge that's an actual meter that goes between full and empty, you know, or has like hi-fi equipment that still actually has, you know, needles on it, or radio that has a needle on it. You know, so at one end, there's like the most intense pleasure that we've ever felt, which you might just reflect for yourself. What is that? What's the most intense pleasure you've ever felt in your life? And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's the most intense pain we've ever felt, which you might consider also, you know, what that's been for you. And then the whole range in between, right? You know, various gradations of pleasure, various gradations of pain, kind of a fairly large territory in the middle where it doesn't strike us as particularly one or the other. So just moment by moment by moment, this is a universal factor of experience. In every moment, there's some impression of Vedana. There's no moment when there's no sense of the feeling tone of whatever we're experiencing, regardless of what we're experiencing. Which this is one aspect of the Dharma that really squares with modern science. So the neuroscience, I don't know that much about it, but this is what they've discovered, right? There's this old portion of the brain, I guess somewhere back here, like the old reptilian brain. And, you know, like our nerve endings take in sensations of heat and pressure and all that kind of thing. And then it travels up and the old brain decides whether it's unpleasant or pleasant, or not much of either, before it ever hits the new brain to figure it out. So before we've even realized what we're experiencing, before we even know consciously or intellectually that we're feeling heat, like the old brain has already decided whether we like it or not, which is exactly what the Abhidhamma, what the Buddhist psychology says, that this is just every moment this is happening. And it's such a fundamental part of our experience, right? It really drives our lives. You know, that determines most of what we choose to do. Do we feel good? Do we feel bad? You know, if we feel good, we want to keep doing whatever it is. If we feel bad, we want to do something else or get away from it, right? If we're bored, we want to find something that will make us feel good. And we don't even have a word for it in English. I think that's a problem. Because often we do have to come to the Dharma and hear the teachings here before we even realize, you know, or really, really, really start to get that this is an operation in our lives all the time. So there's this feeling sense, the pleasure-pain spectrum, Vedana, that's arising with every experience. And for a long time, it can be very difficult to separate that out from the experience that's giving rise to it, right? Or even when we do start to see it, we might not always be able to see it because they're so linked, we've gotten so used to linking them in our mind, in our concepts. So that's okay. You know, if at times we're having experience, it seems like the experience really is pleasant or really is painful, and the experience and the sense of Vedana are really just one compact unit, that's okay. We just notice it that way. But then at times they may separate out. We might be able to see, oh, that physical sensation is one thing, and the sense of the painfulness or pleasantness of it is something else, right? The physical sensation is happening in the physical realm. The sense of Vedana is happening in the mental realm. They're, again, related, but not the same thing. For a long time, this teaching just completely mystified me. I would hear my teachers talk about this. It just made no sense to me. I could not relate to it at all in my direct experience. In the early years of my practice, I didn't know how to sit so my body would be comfortable. Somewhat ironic, I'm much more comfortable now, 30 years on, than I was when I first started sitting, young and healthy. But I didn't know how to sit, like proper body mechanics, and I just had this chronic knee pain, this horrible burning knee pain that would just go on and on and on and on. And when I looked at it, you know, I could see the burning really clearly, like the physical aspect of it was really clear. But I could not see that the pain in it was different from the burning. It just seemed like, how could you possibly see that burning sensation as anything other than painful? Like, it seemed like the pain was just intrinsic to that sensation. It was just built into it. It was part and parcel of it. It seemed like a totally solid entity, the burning and the pain. And my teachers would talk about, no, the pain happens in the mental realm. It's something else. I'm like, what are you talking about? So this is how we often start to get this inkling at some point. You know, often it's through pain. This is one of the ways that pain is a great teacher to us, but it could be through pleasure just as well, of having that point in the practice where the mindfulness is finally sharp enough, the concentration is finally steady enough, deep enough, that we can see those two elements of the experience start to decouple, you know, sometimes we'll have the experience that we're sitting with pain and we're sitting with pain and we're sitting with pain, and at some point, the factors of the mind get strong enough, the wholesome factors, that the unpleasantness falls away. might have had this experience. And the same physical sensations are there, that burning, tearing, tension, whatever it is. But the sense of the painfulness isn't there. Same exact sensations, but without the perception of pain. So that kind of experience starts to give us that understanding, right, that the Vedana really is a separate element of the experience. It's not intrinsic. It's not built into the sensations. And we may even be sitting there with those same sensations of burning, tearing, tension, and start to experience pleasant sensation. This is a phenomena that we encounter sometimes. It's called pleasant pain, where the concentration, the mindfulness, the wisdom has gotten so strong that there are those really intense sensations, but they're not experienced as painful at all because of the quality of the mind, and because that sense of Vedana is mind-generated. It happens in the mind dimension. Perception is a really interesting aspect of what the mind does. This one also took me a really long time to see. So perception, it's translated sometimes as recognition, ideation, conceptualization, but it's like lower level thought, lower level conceptualization. It's like the precursor to thought, kind of short of full-blown, fully formed thoughts. It's the impression that when we encounter physical, mental experiences, we know what they are. We recognize them on kind of a really deep, almost subconscious level, or just barely conscious level. One way that I experience that here is with the sound of the birds here. There's a few of them still going out there. But so I'll be sitting here and it's really quiet. And I'm a bit of a bird watcher. I kind of love birds. So at home, I know all the bird songs. Like I know who all my neighbors are, who all my bird neighbors are, and I hear them out there, and I know who each one is. But here, they don't all sound the same. There's some different ones. So I'll be sitting, and there's just that brief chirp, right? Brief chirp of a bird, or sometimes it's a squirrel or a chipmunk or some other critter. Don't always know what it is, but. So there'll be the hearing, the chirp, that sound, and then like almost immediately there's the perception of bird. And I can tell that it's different from a thought because it doesn't actually say bird. Like it's not the word bird, it's not the image bird, it's not like a fully formed concept. It's just that impression of, oh, I recognize that, I know what that is. I could follow that into a thought if I wanted to, but it's just that like that momentary impression. Recognition, I know what that is, kind of on a pre-verbal level. So that's how perception operates. It's like that just immediate perception, immediate recognition of things before we get to like the fully formed story, which can be really interesting to notice. There's just sometimes that strikes us more than the fully formed thought in those cases where there is some cognition, some conceptualization going on, but it hasn't gone like the whole nine yards all the way into a thought about what's happening. One area that this can be really interesting to explore is with the perception of ourself. This can be a really interesting area to explore. So I notice this also sometimes is that I'm sitting and I'm not actually thinking about myself. Maybe I'm just in the body, feeling the body or hearing sounds or whatever it is. And yet still in that moment, there's the recognition of self. Like this kind of what we talk about is the felt sense of self, the felt sense of me. So it's, Lord knows we spend plenty of time actually thinking about ourselves. But even in those moments where we're not actually, fully thinking about ourselves in a conscious, intellectual way, there's still like that felt sense of, oh, I recognize this experience. I recognize this experience as me. It's a really interesting thing to pick up on. They talk about, in the suttas, they use the phrase sometimes, the conceit I am, the conceit I am, like the sense that I am, which is, again, not the fully formed sense of thinking about ourselves, having ideas about ourselves, but just kind of recognizing that this experience that's happening is somehow me, a really subtle way that we cling to our ideas about self, our perception of self. And then finally is consciousness, the most subtle aspect of what the mind does, and yet really the most obvious. It's kind of like consciousness is so obvious that we miss it. You know, it's like, here we are, right? We know what's going on. We're aware of what's going on. Consciousness, you know, what's the difference between me and the rock? It's got the same earth elements, you know, it's made up of the same atoms, molecules, but there's consciousness here, you know. This is really basic function of just simply knowing, being, you know, some of us think of that's what being alive is, you know, being conscious. So because it's just like such a ubiquitous feature of our mental experience, it can be really hard to pick up on it. It can take a long time to get in touch with consciousness as a momentary experience, as an experience in the moment. But it does come into focus at some point. Often the way that we start to see it is like if we practiced in a style of meditation like where we spend a lot of time focusing on the breath or some other primary experience, some anchoring experience in the meditation, then at a certain point, usually we'll start to notice, oh, there's the breathing going on. And then there's also like the knowing of the breathing, right? Like there can be the sense of an observer that's watching the breath. It's that sense of knowing. You know, there's something happening, and then it's being known. You know, there's a breath, and it's being known. There's a step, it's being known. There's a sound, taste, whatever it is, and it's being known. So that's often how we first start to be able to pick up on consciousness. And at time, and some of you are practicing this way, we may actually shift more to awareness of consciousness than the object of consciousness. So that's one way that some of us find it helpful to practice, is to kind of turn and look at the other side of the coin, paying attention moment to moment at that awareness, that consciousness of what's arising, rather than the content of what's arising. Just watching it flow by, you know, a moment of consciousness of the body, a moment of consciousness of the mind, a moment of consciousness of hearing, you know, just watching like all those moments of consciousness come and go and flow by. So, purification of view, you know, this purification through insight, awakening through insight that the Visuddhimagga talks about in the section on purification of view, it involves this ongoing questioning, this ongoing exploration and investigation of what's really happening, you know, what is really real. And, you know, we arrive at that in stages. It's not like suddenly, all of a sudden, we see in its totality what is real in this moment, what's really happening. It's this process, right? Process of discovering, process of uncovering what's really happening, getting, you know, by stages, a little bit closer to what's really going on. My son right now, he's in elementary school, and you know, in their kind of early science classes that they do, you know, he often has a unit on subjective versus objective, you know, which wouldn't it be great if we all actually learned that in elementary school? What's our opinion and what's actually real? but that's very much, I find, part of the exploration of this path, you know, that really constant questioning, not thinking about it, not analyzing it, but just as we go along and we encounter experience, that having that kind of discerning attitude, okay, is this really real? It's kind of constant skepticism, healthy skepticism, you know, is this really what's happening? Is what I think is happening really what's happening? Or is there concept mixed in there? Is there a layer of interpretation, you know, story making, conceptualizing that's clouding over, that's obscuring what's really happening? So learning, you know, little by little, what's the difference between objective and subjective? You know, again, going back to like my knee pain that I had in those early years, I was sure it was in my knee, you know? But there it is, it's right there, that's my knee, that's where the pain is, where else is it going to be, you know? That concept was just so plastered on to that sensation, there was no separating it out. I was sure I was feeling my knee. And go on a little bit further, you know, we come to see that, oh, knee is really just an idea, that's really just a story too. You know, it's not as complicated as some of the stories that we tell ourselves. Like somebody was saying, you know, daydreams are easy because it's really obvious that they're stories. You know, but knee is also a story. The stories get very subtle, very deep. We can also reflect on, as we go along, you know, when we hear these teachings about what are the actual elements of experience, this relatively limited set of stuff in the body, relatively limited set of stuff in the mind, we encounter something in our experience that seems very complicated, then we can kind of investigate into it. Well, can this be broken down into more fundamental concepts? You know, especially if we're like caught in a story about something, we can remember this teaching like, okay, I know, I've heard that this is just made up of these relatively few physical mental phenomena. Can I actually identify some of those in there? So again, not getting like caught up in a lot of analysis or intellectual investigation, but just kind of like dropping in a little deeper. You know, it's a learning process how to do this nonverbal investigation, how to drop in more fully, activate this quality of Dhamma Vichaya, which is sometimes translated as investigation, this movement of awareness closer to experience, right? Closer to experience, deeper to experience, getting more immersed into experience, investigating it in that way. You know, can we feel more fully the physical elements? Can we feel more fully the mental elements? Rather than trying to figure it out and analyzing it, but feeling into it, you know? And maybe sometimes we drop the question in there, you know, we drop in the question, what's really happening right there, right now? But then we don't try to answer it with words. Instead, we try to feel into it and answer it with our actual experience. Okay, so it looks like that's enough for tonight. I'll continue with this next time until you guys are good and tired of hearing me talk about what's actually happening right now. It's always good to get reminded. So let's finish by sharing the merit for our practice here. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these,
May darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.